This message comes from OnPoint's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you qualify, and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Click, tap, swipe, scroll, thumbs up, down, like, the daily motions of our digital lives. But you know what those actions also describe? They describe how we read. Click, tap, swipe, scroll. Notice what we're not doing. Pause, contemplate, reflect. Those are the things that Marianne Wolfe says we're supposed to do when we're reading deeply. In fact, Wolfe, a cognitive scientist, says that the digital world is changing how our brains are wired to read, and that it might be reducing both our empathy and capacity for critical thinking. But she's got a plan to help us, and especially our kids, regain the profound joys of deep reading. This hour on Point, the reading brain in a digital world. You can join us on air or online. Do you think it's gotten harder for you to stay focused on old-fashioned books? Have digital distractions caused you to skim rather than immerse yourself in what you're reading? And what effect is this having on kids? And by the way, do you think this is just more fear-mongering about technology? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now is Marianne Wolfe. She's incoming director of UCLA's Center for Dyslexia, Diverse Learners, and Social Justice. Her new book is Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. You can find an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. And she joins us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Marianne, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure, Meghna.
It's great to have you. So I was wondering if you might start by telling us a story from your own experience about how living the online life has changed you. You're a cognitive scientist who studies literacy. How has it? You went through an experience where you tested yourself on how you read. Can you tell us that story?
Indeed, Meghna. The last thing I ever thought was that I myself, who am aware of all the weaknesses that can happen, would be similarly affected like everybody that I try to caution on my weekends. So what I did, Meghna, I just out of pure curiosity, I decided to do a single cell design with myself as the subject. And I decided to read a book that in my graduate days had been one of my absolute favorite books. It was Hermann Hesse's Glass Bead Game, which is a very dense, complex book, not Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, which would be way too simple. But no, I chose Hesse's Glass Bead Game, also called Magus Ludi, because when I knew the plot.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to, forgive me for interrupting, but when you first read it in your younger years, what is it that you loved about it then?
I loved the very complexity. I loved the idea of how we might think about the future in ways that I had never imagined before. And so the very appeal initially to me was that it was one of the more intellectually stimulating, thought-provoking books and going in directions that I myself would never have imagined. Uh-huh. So it was with no small glee that I thought, this is the perfect experiment. It's complex. It's dense. I know the plot. And so I can just immerse myself. But Meghna, as you already have whetted the listener's appetite, it was like pouring molasses over my cerebral cortex. I couldn't read it. I couldn't focus. What I was doing was literally using the mode of reading that I used 6 to 12 hours a day. So I was using my screen mode of reading, which was absolutely incapacitating me in terms of entering it.
Well, can I just ask you? So, I mean, it sounds like you couldn't even bear to read the book. I mean, that this thing that had given you so much pleasure was eliciting the exact opposite emotions in you.
Oh, Meghna, I'm embarrassed. embarrassed to report that I literally questioned why the Nobel Prize for Literature had ever been given to Norman S. And then I thought, I wonder if HarperCollins would ever publish this book today.
Wow.
And then I just thrust it back into my alphabetized H shelf and then thought about, what have I done? Books, this book was one of my friends of my youth, of my graduate programs. It was Hermann Hesse was a friend to my intellect. He had been a part of the contribution of my background knowledge, and I had just rudely thrust it away.
I'm sorry to keep interrupting you here. Just one of the drawbacks of being 3,000 miles apart as we have this conversation.
I know. I wish I could see you.
But I'm curious, though, because the very immersive nature that drew you into this book to begin with was the thing that it seemed as if your brain was rebelling against when you went back and reread it.
You were absolutely correct. What I could not do was find that reflective, contemplative mode of reading, which had been for me how I read years ago in not just my youth, my young adulthood. And it was as if it had been replaced, and I use that word very selectively, replaced by a mode of reading that could certainly read other novels. I read as much fiction as nonfiction, but this very dense, complex, syntactically and conceptually demanding novel was not being, there was no ease in me entering it. So here is the good news, Meghna, and that's really, I know why you asked me. I decided I cannot desert a friend. And so I went back and I simply made a discipline of reading 20 minutes a night for what took almost 10 to 12 days, almost 2 weeks. And then it was as if a switch was replacing the other mode that had rebelled against it. And here's why, in part, I gave the title to the book. It was as if I have come home to my former reading self. I felt the holding ground, the sanctuary has been refound.
Yeah.
And I realized if this happens to me, who knows all the, if you will, the idiosyncrasies of our present reading styles, it can well affect many people.
Now, I hear the hope and I hear the passion in what you're saying, but I just want to be clear. You're not I'm going to talk in a second about how the brain changes when it's reading digitally versus long-form books, but you're not calling for us to smash our iPhones and throw the tablets out the window. Because, I mean, look, many people do most of their reading online or their information processing online these days. Are you saying that there's some sort of middle way, some sort of way we can train our brains to have the same immersive experiences online or not? What are you saying?
Do you know, Meghna, this is a question that I am asking myself and that I am hoping to develop, if you will, proposals for people to examine in a much more systematic, rigorous research context. What I am aiming for is for the development of a reading set of styles, not one, but a set of styles that we can intentionally use after we have discovered our own purposes for whatever we're reading. In other words, the screen reading mode is appropriate for much of our reading, but for that which is requiring, and this is very intentional, which we know is requiring our fullest concentration and the desire to consolidate that information into knowledge, I believe we must be vigilant about reallocating time to what I call the deep reading processes.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no question in my life that I had changed as much as the readers I am writing for. But what my real worry is, is that it's one thing for adults who have long built up this deep reading brain. It's one thing for us to return to it. It is another question for those who have not yet developed
right.
such a deep reading circuit.
Right. And we're going to talk about that because I know a lot of people
yes,
listening
of course.
Are probably thinking of their kids right
uh-huh.
now. But I'm curious, though, when you say, this is something that I think would benefit us if we just got your definition of when you say deep reading,
yes.
what exactly do you mean?
That requires me to take just one step backward to tell the story of the reading brain, simply, briefly, but it will expose the requirement for us to understand deep reading even more over the spaces. So we were never meant. We were never born to read. We don't have a single genetic program for reading to unfold the way we do language and vision and cognitive processes. Rather, reading is a cultural invention.
Mm-hmm.
This means that our incredibly pluripotential brain is able to form new circuits for new cognitive functions. So, we build this new circuitry by rearranging the parts that are genetically programmed. So we are building new networks between vision and language and cognition and affect. Now, that's the good news. It's a plastic circuit. It can learn to read Chinese and form a circuit for Chinese or Hebrew or French or German. But every circuit is slightly different. That plasticity allows us to do that. But the same plasticity means that we will be influenced by the characteristics of the medium.
Yeah.
Now,
Can I just, I'm going to take it from you there because I have to go
of
into
course.
A break here, but we'll pick up where you left off in just a minute here. We're speaking with Marianne Wolf. She's the incoming director of UCLA's Center for Dyslexia, Diverse Learners, and Social Justice. And she's got a new book out. It's called Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. And we're talking about how to recapture that immersive, deep reading experience that you should get with books in the digital world. Have you found it harder recently to pick up a book and stay with it? Let us know. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply. Based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And if you are holding a digital device in your hand right now, I'm just going to ask you to put it down for a second because we are talking about reading deeply in the digital age and, you know, what it's like for many of us who feel like we struggle to pick up a book these days and stay with it because perhaps our brains are being retrained to read in entirely different ways based on what we see on the internet. And we're talking with Marianne Wolf. She's the incoming director of UCLA's Center for Dyslexia, Diverse Learners, and Social Justice. She's written a remarkable new book called Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. And, you know, we are so surrounded by the effects of our digital lives. I just want to play a couple of pieces of tape that really reflect that. First of all, here's comedian Paula Poundstone on CBS Sunday Morning back in 2015. She was actually calling out parents for passing screens, that provide addiction or getting kids addicted to screens.
Addiction hampers judgment. You see it. Everywhere you look, people are staring at their flat things. We're terrified of being bored. No one drifts or wonders. If Robert Frost had lived today, he would have written, "Whose woods are these? I think I'll Google it."
And speaking of Google, in 2009, then CEO of Google Eric Schmidt actually said he was worried about losing the ability to think deeply in the digital age.
I worry that the level of interrupt, right, this sort of overwhelming rapidity of information, and especially of stressful information, is in fact affecting cognition. It is in fact affecting deeper thinking. I still believe that sitting down and reading a book is the best way to really learn something.
That's former CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, back in 2009. Marianne Wolf, let me ask you. I mean, you describe in great detail in the book about sort of the complex circuitry using multiple parts of the brain that are employed every time we read, even when we're reading a single word and trying to impute the meaning of that
right.
word. And this is something that, as you were saying before the break, we only recently developed in the past several thousand years of, you know, all of human history. But how
yes.
does that circuitry for reading conventional, you know, words on a page, how does that differ from the circuitry that's employed in the brain when we're absorbing information digitally?
I'm going to step back just
okay,
the tiniest
that's all right.
bit, Magna, because I want to be sure to say what the deep reading processes are, because that is what differentiates the print versus digital screen
okay,
reading,
go ahead.
The use of those processes. So basically, we have this wonderful circuit, and it can be very, very basic, just connecting language and perception. And so we are very much able to decode information and stop. Or we can, as you and I have developed, use that only as the basis for ever more elaborated processes. And so those include connecting the information that's in front of us with what we know. That's the background knowledge. That's who we are as human beings. We are analogy makers. So we connect what is new with what we know. And that also depends on how much we know, the nature of what we know. That then becomes the basis for what I call the scientific method parts of deep reading. Inference, deduction, induction. That then becomes one huge contributor to one of the two most important deep reading processes in my mind, which are critical analysis, which connects all of those other deep reading processes, and empathy. Surprisingly, not only do we think about that new information, but we have an affective relationship to it. Have we entered the perspective of another viewpoint? Have we entered the perspective of another person? Are we using empathic and also very cognitive processes to understand what that material is from a both cognitive and affective
yeah.
level, which allows us to really think deeply. That becomes the basis for personal and sometimes even larger insight into that material. All of those deep reading processes require the allocation of time. And that is what is different about digital and print reading modes of reading.
Okay, so can
what
I just jump in here?
Can
I, if
yes.
I may, because I'd like to offer
sure.
a little counterexample, because I want to tease
okay.
apart what you mean by the allocation of time. And
because
I'll just use myself as the counterexample.
Sure, of course.
A couple of years ago, I decided to sort of move all of the preparation that I do for these conversations,
mm-hmm.
move it online, right? So
yes.
this
yes.
wonderful team here and other teams that I've worked with, they create a Google Doc, essentially, that's
yes.
full of research that they give to me.
Yeah, right.
And as I'm reading the Google Doc, it's got dozens of articles in it, whatnot,
mm-hmm.
I, you know, oftentimes I find myself highlighting certain things and then
yes.
Google searching
mm-hmm.
the questions that rise in my mind as I'm reading, and I, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm putting links in, et cetera, and sort of building
right.
Yet another interactive packet based on the reading that I'm doing. Now, this is
yes.
all happening digitally. It's all happening online.
Yes.
And I would say
yes.
that, in fact, because of that, I can read deeper. My critical
mm-hmm.
thinking is pushed farther because there's an instantaneous mm-hmm. access to information and answers to questions that are being generated as I'm reading. So what's the problem?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in the, this is a really beautiful example. One of the things that I want to be sure people understand is that this is not an argument about binary differences between print and digital. What I'm suggesting is that what we have to do, and you are actually giving us a beautiful example of it, is to be vigilantly allocating time to critical analytic processes in any medium. But the rub is that not everyone, Meghna, does what you have just done. You have learned to do that. You have learned to allocate critical analytic processes. The problem is that each medium actually has certain processes, and you have just described some of them. How do we handle multiple sources of information and prioritize it? That's a wonderful advanced and, if you will, expansion of our circuit. But in large part, most of us, most of the time, are doing what I would consider entering the digital chain of reading, in which the glut of information causes us not to do what you did, but in fact to either triage or to go to what I would call, and I movement researchers called, the skimming mode of reading, in which we use either an F or a Z pattern for our reading. We sample the top, we do a little word spotting in the middle, and then we go down. Or we just go across the top like a Z, diagonal, skip word spot down to the bottom. And basically, we have missed the development of argumentation. We have even missed what I would call the perception of the beauty that many writers work assiduously to give their reader by the closest approximation of words to their thought.
Yeah.
So even though you, and I just love what you just did, even though you gave us an example of how digital reading can actually expand those deep reading processes, in large part, what is happening is that that skimming mode, how we read, involves not just how we read, but what we read. And we end up less dense, more reduced, often unadjudicated sources of information, which we then believe.
This is such an important point.
This makes us susceptible to false, fake everything, whether it's fears, false fears, or fake news, or the accusation of fake news. We have become more susceptible because of this, what I'm calling the digital chain, and it's unintentional.
Yeah.
I don't believe there's any intentionality here.
Can I just jump in here for a second?
The best intention.
I just want to jump in for a second because I just want to be clear. I'm not putting myself on a pedestal here as the epitome of deep digital reading. When you're describing sort of the F or Z pattern of eye movement across the page, guilty as charged also frequently.
Yes.
But I want to get to a bunch of callers here because we've got people with thoughts about this. We're speaking with Marianne Wolfe. She's author of Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. And we're talking about how, you know, how we read online and how that's changing our brains and what that means for our capacity for deep reading. And Marianne Wolfe also has, by the way, she's got a plan to help us become deep readers. Once again, we'll get to that in a minute. But I'm curious to hear if people think that all the information that we're processing digitally has made it harder for them to read deeply. Let's go to Rick, who's calling from Garden City, Michigan. You're on the air, Rick.
Hi, Meghna. Marianne, I love the show. The topic is fascinating. I'm a CPA, and predominantly what I do for a major corporation is I read a lot of contracts. And as you indicate, Meghna, what I find myself doing is, because of those reading skills that are required in what I do, I'm finding I'm analyzing a lot more of the content that I actually read online. On the other hand, to your point, Marianne, what I have found, the younger people coming in that don't have that experience, years of experience reading contracts and sifting out the intent, What is the actual agreement comprised of? They're coming in with that internet, if you will, mentality, where they're skimming through the contract. And I find in many cases they are glancing over important points, and they're not looking at the crux of what the two parties are trying to agree to. And I see that in the work environment as well. So I've experienced your point, Magna, and as well as your point, Marianne. I think that's fascinating. But what I wanted to point out was this. While I do believe that that type of reading is hindering or is not fully developing younger readers going through high school and college and what have you, because they're so ingrained in the internet environment.
Yeah.
I find that they're reading much, much more than they may have ordinarily, which may provide a crop for future novel readers. And I'm interested in what's your take on that.
Rick, thank you so much for your call. Marianne, go ahead.
Well, the reality, Rick, is that we are all consuming between 50 and 100,000 words a day. The problem is that it's relatively rare for it to be continuous, focused, or long reading. Now, to your point about the young, there are really interesting studies being conducted by Anne Mangan, Marie Barzilai, Jenny Thompson in Norway, England, and Israel, in which they're comparing young people who are digital natives, if you will, on the same material, a lusty French novel called Jeune Mon Amour, and they're reading it on print versus digital. They assume they will do better on digital. The reality is that they are missing details. They are not sequencing, which has ramifications for their ultimate comprehension.
Wait, so for the same text you're saying?
For the exact same text.
Wow.
There are different results in comprehension, but specifically on just what Rick is pointing out. They are failing to capture, and if you think about the Z or the F as just a sort of a shorthand way of looking at skimming, they're skipping some of the argument, the detail, the sequencing of the plot, so that their overall understanding is impeded. Not grossly, I don't want to make, there are strong arguments here, and there are middle and there are weak. I have a middle hypothesis about what's happening, but it's a hypothesis that will lead us to say, if these weaknesses are there, how can we actually take the very system with those weaknesses to redress it?
I'm curious to hear what your hypothesis is, because it seems remarkable to me that with the same text, you could get such different outcomes. I mean, is the medium, the digital medium, just priming the brain to behave differently?
Priming is a great selection of words, Magna. We are creatures of habit. And so when we learn to read quickly, the glut of information that we all have, and Eric Schmidt, I quote him as well, there's two things happening when we read online, especially in the internet. We have both a glut of information and we have a bombardment of stimuli that are distracting us. Human beings have a novelty bias. We will look at whatever is new, but especially children. They don't have the same inhibitory system. So they will be having what is often called continuous partial attention. Well, continuous partial attention is a different quality of attention than what Rick is describing that he possesses and that allows him to, because of his whole background, to select those details, know which ones are important, and actually allocate time to it so he consolidates it. Kids and our youth do not have either the same inhibitory system to deal with the glut and the distractions. Mm-hmm. So they miss out on the allocation of time to consider those details important to the overall analysis of the text.
This is getting us to your plan, your idea of how to to raise deep readers here. And we got a minute here to go before the break. So, but I wonder if you could just start unfolding it. I mean, it sounds to me like you're saying, what is it, between the ages of 0 and 5, that we ought to create a precious protected space for a young person's brain to develop, so that it, you know, gets those, it builds those the structure so that it can ignore distraction.
A beautiful physician pediatrician in Boston is Barry Zuckerman, and he and Jenny Radesky, another pediatrician, are really, I'm working with them as well, or with Barry, we're really trying to think about the 0 to 5 period as a time of introduction in which digital technology is basically never used as either a pacifier or a babysitter, but rather as one of the great, wonderful things in the nursery, but never the one that's used most. So it's very gradual.
Yeah.
I'll return to 5 to 10, which is even more
great. And we'll get to some calls, too, here, because people have a lot of good questions for you. I'm speaking with Marianne Wolfe. She's author of Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. And if you're out there listening and you're, say, the parents of kids, and have you watched them interact with those digital devices? Do you wonder how it's affecting or enhancing their ability to read? Let us know. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here. And on the latest episode of How I Built This, how Stuart Butterfield failed in 2 companies, pivoted, and then built 2 amazing new companies, Flickr and Slack. Check out How I Built This wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking with Marianne Wolfe. She's the incoming director of UCLA's Center for Dyslexia, Diverse Learners, and Social Justice. And she's author of the terrific new book. It's called Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. And Marianne, before the break, we were talking about sort of your plan on how to teach young kids, especially, how to become deep readers. And I do want to come back to that in a second here. But there are so many callers who've been, they've been practicing a form of patience and contemplation waiting on the line, and I want to reward them for that. So let's go to them first here. Elizabeth is calling from Norman, Oklahoma. You're on the air, Elizabeth.
Hi, Meghna. Great speaking to you.
You too. What's your thought for today?
So I am a doctoral student at the University of Oklahoma, and I've noticed, especially kind of in the last few years since entering grad school, that I experienced sort of a reader fatigue, and I love reading. I consumed books voraciously as a kid, but now I read all these academic articles and I get home and I want to sit and read books for, you know, pleasure reading, fun reading. And I find that I sit down and I can't focus on these books. And then I can't even really remember the salient details after reading for 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And I find myself having to flip back.
Maybe you're just tired, Elizabeth. reading for academic literature is hard work. I'm sympathizing here. Like, maybe you're just tired.
For sure. And then also there's sort of in tandem with that, you know, I mean, I'm so thankful for the internet, because you read an academic article and you're sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, what the heck is that? I'm a music student, so a lot of this stuff recently has been delving into philosophy, and so then, of course, I go to Google, and I'm looking up all these philosophers, and then, you know, you fall into the Wikipedia hole of you're taking a 30-minute detour into semiotics, and it's sort of a blessing and a curse, you know? But I definitely feel like I fall into that kind of Z pathway.
Right.
Of skimming.
Oh, interesting. Elizabeth, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Lisa here. She's calling from Broadway, Virginia. You're on the air.
Hi, Magna. I'm Dr. Wolf.
Hello.
We have an 8-year-old grandson. He is extremely bright. I'm not saying that just from grandparent pride. It can be observed in many, many aspects by others. But he is having a hard time reading. He comes from a very digital savvy family. He has had tablets in his hand. He has an engineer's mind. The kid can figure out how to work or fix anything. And the reading is really frustrating him. So he's in all kinds of special programs, and yet we haven't found something that really accesses his brain. And listening to you, I'm wondering if his early exposure to digital media hasn't taken over those pathways, and if there are different ways to approach this for him that we haven't hit on yet.
Lisa, thank you so much for your call. Marianne Wolf, this leads us right back to where we were before the break. So go ahead.
Right. Lisa, one of the things that I would want you to at least think about is that one of our most invaluable brains, and the human being has a need for diverse brain organizations, but many an engineer, many an architect, many an artist actually has difficulty learning to read because of a different organization. There's a continuum of dyslexia that our extremely bright individuals often have that's undiagnosed. And I would at least like you to consider that as something that I see so often in college, is where the students have never been diagnosed because they're so smart. They've been compensating like crazy. But in fact, they have an undiagnosed, what I would call a fluency-based reading issue. So it might, Lisa, be of help to at least have a good evaluation of your grandson, because he sounds so much like my own son who had a profile very similar to that. So I would be much more likely to think in those lines than to look at the ramifications of too early uses of digital technology. My friend and colleague Catherine Steiner Adair has also written a book that you might find of great interest called The Big Disconnect, in which she talks about children who in fact have had adverse effects of digital technology, leading not so much to a failure to learn to read, but to attention issues that then cause struggles with learning, or even so far as addiction. That might be good for you.
But Marianne, I hear you about the specifics of Lisa's grandson, but I'm also thinking about the age that he's in, right? She said he was about 8 now. And there are, you know, millions of kids across the country who are right in that age range. We were talking about 0 through 5 beforehand what to do. Then in those years, in order to sort of help create the right pathways so that they can later on become deep readers. Right. But what about between the ages of 5 to 10? I mean, these are times of, in modern life, of pretty heavy screen usage for kids.
Exactly. And Meghna, I'm so glad you brought us back, because I tended to go into the world of dyslexia just to help. But the reality is that I believe what we should be thinking about is not a binary plan, but in fact a parallel plan of helping our children learn to read, most of them. Now, there are individual differences, but for most of them, I would like most of our children to learn to read on the kinesthetic, tactile print, so that they would be learning these deep reading skills using what I consider almost a full flush of that circuitry from the start, because print does slow us down, and I don't want our children sped up in the beginning with their reading, but I do with their programming skills, their coding skills on digital screen media. So with my colleague Cynthia Brazil at MIT, we're always thinking of the best ways of using digital technology. Certainly there is, like with Scratch Junior, the people like Mitch Resnick or Marina Bears at Tufts. We have people who are doing amazing things on how do we develop the inferential skills, the spatial skills that are so wonderfully emphasized in digital media. Well, those same inferential skills are useful for deep reading. That's a piece of it. But in the beginning, between 5 and 8 or 5 and 10, what I am suggesting, and I have not a research body of evidence, which I usually have to support almost anything I say. This is my proposal based on existing research, and I would like others to research it so that we, not unlike Vygotsky, who thought about thought and language in separate paths that then become intertwined, I would like the same thing, to learn deep reading skills with print, and after they're really in place, instead of having the bad habits that most of us have, that we really understand how to use deep reading purposefully and then have teachers explicitly teach those deep reading skills on digital screens when they're ready. And there's a wonderful new book that's coming out, edited by Marit Barzilai and Jenny Thompson, about learning to read in digital worlds. And Marit was my student, and I consider that book also a wonderful resource for people.
So, Marianne, I have a question for you here. Sometimes when I have these conversations, I have to check myself, because I don't want to let the conversation drift into this space where we just presume that kids are going to always use a digital device over a book, right? Because I'm just thinking that,
you know, that's not true.
Yeah, because if you observe, I suppose, especially pre-readers, to be honest, like you observe them, children effortlessly allow themselves to get immersed in books, in picture books or whatnot.
Absolutely.
I mean, we all can imagine kids like laying on their bellies on the floor with their, you know, their feet up, just kind of looking at a book. It's not as if I'm not sure they naturally prefer the digital devices is what I'm saying.
You know, it's fascinating that you should say that, because the reality is that part of the book is that, just like Piaget suggested, we're using so many sensory modalities, including eating the book. You can't eat an iPad.
Kids try, though. I'm sure they do.
Please don't. But the reality is that there's so many things going on. But it's slower. It's not a constant source of almost the continuous stimulation. It's a slower medium at a time when I believe our children are better suited for the slightly slower modalities in print. That is not to say that they should have digital devices forbidden. We're all, as I said in the book, we're all children of Adam and Eve. You forbid something and it becomes the forbidden fruit. Yeah. We don't want to outlaw it, nor ever use it as a reward. Oh, you've been good, so I do this. No. It should be gradually introduced, and it should be become just a natural part of the environment, but not overuse, so that what you said earlier happens almost all the time when I ask audiences what happens when children who are so immersed in digital media between 0 and 5 go offline. What do they say? I'm bored.
Uh-huh.
Well, we are creating, unfortunately, a new form of ennui, a new form of boredom. Boredom can be, as Walter Benjamin said, the hatchbird of creativity. But instead, it becomes so often when they go online, they really have fight, flight hormonal increases.
Right, right.
And you don't come down off that as easily as if you know, after a book, there is a rare child who says, I'm bored.
Right.
And after a screen, you do.
I was saying about that fight-flight response based on digital stimuli. Same thing happens to adults as well. But I don't want to neglect our caller.
Yes.
So let's go to Holden, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. You're on the air, Holden.
Hi, Meghna. Hi, Dr. Wolf. My question is this. So you started talking about like a skimming method. First off, I'm sorry. I wanted to say that I completely agree with what you're saying about deep reading and its importance and the pleasure of the text and letting people slow down and think. But my question is, when you started talking about the skimming method, it made me think of speed reading, and I dabbled in speed reading, and you can really accelerate your ability to read. And we're just consuming much, so much like information in college and now like this, you know, on the internet and on our devices. And shouldn't we be teaching children speed reading too? You know what I mean? To maybe say, look, we can't fight this. And in fact, people are needing to consume more information. So maybe while we're at the time of teaching deep reading, maybe we should teach speed reading and, you know, give the children a choice. And is that something that, that makes sense? Should we, I mean, I don't see it slowing down anytime soon.
Yeah. Holden, thank you so much for your call. Marianne Wolf, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a great question, Holden. And I have thought about it. And in fact, there are programs out there that are doing that, not dissimilar from the past. The problem with that that I see is that we aren't really teaching the first principle, which is what is the purpose of whatever we're reading. It becomes everything is a wash in how fast we can, in fact, extract information. So, and cognitively, my biggest worry is that that does not allow us for the very important aspect of comprehension monitoring in children, which is recursion, being able to go back, being able to check. The screen and speed reading both have that as a problematic aspect. So, Holden, I will literally hold your question in suspension because I think the future is going to have to help us figure out when to skim, how to skim, and when not to. So that, so your question to me is still open to me. I'm more, if you will, disposed against it, but it's something that I think we really do need to think about. But the most important point I want to make about skimming, and I do not want to neglect it, is that when we skim, we also simultaneously are usually retreating, because we've got this glut of information, to the simplest, least dense, most familiar silo sources of information that don't challenge us, that don't challenge our viewpoints, that lead us to be more, again, more susceptible to superficial, unadjudicated sources of information.
So, Marianne, can I just
that
jump in here?
Because yes, that's what I worry about.
Well, we've got about a minute and a half left, and it's not enough time, but I did want to explore this more deeply
yes.
with you.
Good!
Because, I mean, you dedicate quite a bit of the book to this, that you're drawing connections between the reduction in the amount of deep reading that we're doing
yes.
and the effects that has on us as citizens in the society that we live in. I mean, do you really feel that strongly about it?
Yes. The last thing I thought as a cognitive neuroscientist was that I would ever be really worried about the effect of the changes of these processes on our democratic society. But if you think about what I said about deep reading processes, the two things that I emphasized were critical analysis and empathy. When we fail to allocate sufficient time to those two processes, it leads us not just to be susceptible to false news, but it leads us to be susceptible to demagoguery with its simple messages of fear. And if you do this, you will reap the rewards. Well, this is a Twitter mentality that reduces the complexities of the issues we need both critical analysis and empathy for, lest we see other, as Marilyn Robinson said, as sinister rather than a piece of the many voices of a democratic society.
Well, if I may end by quoting from your own book, Marianne, you write, "The atrophy and gradual disuse of our analytical and reflective capacities as individuals are the worst enemies of a truly democratic society for whatever reason, in whatever medium, and in whatever age." Well, Marianne Wolf is author of Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. She's the incoming director of UCLA's Center for Dyslexia, Diverse Learners, and Social Justice. It has been such a pleasure and so fascinating to talk with you this hour, Marianne. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna, for me as well. And it was a delight.
By the way, we've got an excerpt of the book on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Thank you.